all this stuff switching around. But if you weren't, just very thrilled to introduce a dear friend, scholar, pastor, former student, former TA of this class, former student of this class, Reverend Dr. Nathan Walton, who finished his undergraduate degree here at UVA with off-the-chart honors, as you probably aren't surprised, then went to Duke Divinity School and completed his Master's of Divinity, but could not quite shake off his desire and his interest to be back in Charlottesville. And are we delighted that that Nathan returned and did his master's and PhD here, during which time he was a teaching fellow, he was a research fellow, he was a fellow at the Project on Lived Theology. After you finished your brilliant dissertation on Dietrich Bonhoeffer and Martin Luther King and sort of a critique of the prosperity gospel, ever heard of that sort of that kind of theological school, pastoral school. What year was that?
Finished in 2018.
Now, I have still that photograph of us in the dome room with Paul and others. Dr. Walton took a position as the executive director of Charlottesville's Abundant Life Ministry, which is a faith-based community development project that has been in Charlottesville, running strong.
Almost 30 years now.
Yeah,
really. We just went to the anniversary when I was here.
But really?
Yeah.
And after 3 or 4 years of generative leadership, took the call at a very interesting church in Richmond, East End Fellowship, that has, last time I checked, quite a number of UVA grads in the ranks. Maybe that will be part of your talk today or some reference to that. But it has its roots, I think, in the was it originally a Presbyterian church?
With
an intentionally interracial congregation with, do you still have co-pastors, black-white?
Well, two black now because I replaced the white one.
There
another
you go.
Black one retired, so just me soon.
Okay, excellent. And, you had afternoon services on Sunday.
Still do.
4 o'clock?
Yeah.
That's like such a great time.
That's great.
If you go to church and if you have any hope of like making it to church, 4 o'clock seems like a pretty good time.
No excuse.
Yeah. Yes, like Dr. King, so many remarkable kind of synergies, some the similarities we won't get into today. But Dr. Walton had opportunities as he was finished his doctorate to move into both academic and pastoral ministerial careers. And like Dr. King, Dr. Walton weighed the options and against his skills and his passions and his desires, and at least for now has pursued the pastoral kind of get deep in the weeds, in a community of faith journey, and works, I would say, as a pastoral theologian in your congregational life. So we are thrilled you're back and look forward to this presentation. Let's welcome three-time UVA alum, Dr. Nathan Walton, back to Kingdom God in America.
Awesome. Well, thanks for having me back. I'm going to slide this over to you a little bit, make sure I'm centered. I'll move that back. Well. It's always fun to be back here. I think I mentioned last time it's very nostalgic to be back in this space, especially because this is, I guess there are two classes here that I both taught and took. I actually taught this one twice. And so it's cool to be back here. So we've got a lot to cover. And this afternoon we're going to talk a bit about MLK and his role and his identity as a pastor, a theologian, a cultural critic in some ways. And it was interesting, earlier today I was texting our oldest parishioner at my church. He's in his mid-80s. And interestingly, he shares the same birthday as MLK, as is my brother, ironically. But also, he was telling me about how he attended Ebenezer and actually heard both MLK and MLK's dad preach in Atlanta back in the 60s. And so I mentioned that, one, because I think it's fascinating to meet somebody who like was around MLK, but also because I think it's a reminder that we're going to be talking about a lot of history today, but that history actually wasn't as far back as we might think.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, to do that, we're going to have to lay some historical foundation to get into King, and we want to situate King within the context of the mid-20th century Black church, the broader civil rights movement, and the key thinkers, social traditions, and experiences that shaped him. King was not a man without a context. He, like every person, was a product of a particular time, a particular place, and a particular people. In other words, I want to first paint the picture of the historical, social, and theological sources that helped to inform and facilitate King's formation and his future work. And then we're going to spend some time turning to the key themes that highlight King's contribution to the civil rights movement, including his understandings of nonviolent direct action and agape love. I'm sure you'll return to these things again on Thursday. With that being said, there are two questions that are going to guide our time together. The first is, how did King become King? In other words, what are the sources for his theological vision and his social impact? And second, how might we understand King's significance during his lifetime and his ongoing relevance for our own lifetime? How might we do that? And afterward, we're going to allow some time for some questions if you have some. You'll have even more opportunity on Thursday. But let's begin with the context of the Black church in America. To understand the role and significance of the Black church for King's formation, it's important to first consider its historical role for the Black community in general. From its inception, the Black church has functioned as a staple of Black religious life in America, but also socio-political life. From the days of the first African slave converts to the religious lives of African-American Christians enduring the Jim Crow South, to even the Black church today, African-Americans have long found relief and refuge from day-to-day oppression by participating in Christian community. Socially, this community has provided a space for corporate solidarity. It has given Blacks the space to affirm one another's dignity in a world in which they were often deprived of it. Particularly during slavery and the postbellum era, Black Christians were unique in that Blacks, these communities were unique, and that Blacks could exercise autonomy and public leadership, as the preacher was one of the first public leaders in the Black American community. As Black Christians sought, throughout American history, participated in religious rituals together, from singing to clapping to dancing, they also shared in daily struggles together, enduring the impacts of racism and discrimination. This means that Black Christianity was born in the midst of suffering and collective trauma. As a result, Black Christianity was always connected to the tangible. It was always connected to the lived experiences of those who practiced it. And this has been evident in the specific biblical themes that have dominated Black church rhetoric, you know, Black preaching, and even Black Christian music, from slave spirituals to the rise of gospel, have always been marked by themes of liberation and uplift, often drawing from biblical passages like the Exodus. Blacks found a message of liberation in Christianity, not just from sin, but from the concrete expressions of oppression, like racism. So on the one hand, Black Christianity's emphasis on the tangibleness of faith was an issue of rhetoric, as sermons and song lyrics often reflected Black identification with Israel's journey towards freedom. But on the other hand, the tangibleness and physicality of faith was also reflected in expressive and embodied worship. Initially drawing from West African religious practices, the faith expressions of Black slaves always involved things like dancing, call and response, expressive singing, high emotion, and the assumption of the Spirit's presence. Black Christianity has always been an issue of both the mind and the body. These are elements of Black religiosity that began in what were called the hush harbors of slave religion, and they can still be seen in today's churches, especially in Pentecostal circles. Now, I mention this because these things help to demonstrate that King's ability to seamlessly blend notions of personal piety with social activism were impressive, but they weren't altogether new. He inhabited a long tradition of theologically informed social engagement and an embodied faith. Embodied faith. You can see themes of social engagement in his sermons and speeches, and you can see themes of embodiment in everything from physically marching and boycotting to hearing the musicality of his sermons. And so King's involvement in the church began at an early age, as he was raised in a Baptist family, attending Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, where his dad was the pastor. And although the Black church has a long-standing history of connecting piety with social engagement, when King was beginning to be formed within the church, he had not yet made the types of connections between those two things that would characterize his later activism. As King got older, he did not initially plan on becoming a minister. This shift only became an interest after he enrolled at Morehouse College in Atlanta. There he was exposed to the preaching of people like Benjamin Mays, the college president at the time, and William Borders, another Baptist minister, who effectively balanced compelling preaching with an intellectual rigor that helped to convince King of the gospel's social relevance. The interesting thing is that for the majority of his young adult life, King had doubts about the social relevance of his faith because he struggled to see how emotionalism and an emphasis on personal piety connected to the Black struggle. Entering college and being exposed to more socially engaged examples of ministry, especially among Black Baptist ministers, these things deepened King's faith and increased his interest in becoming a minister. Now, King would later become ordained. King would eventually become ordained as a Baptist minister in 1948. And that same year, King would enter seminary and begin reading people like Walter Rauschenbusch. Have y'all read Walter Rauschenbusch?
Yeah.
Oh, fantastic.
Sure.
As you know, an early 20th century theologian who drew deep connections between the biblical claims of Jesus about sin and an understanding of sin as a social and a systemic phenomenon. So reading thinkers like Rauschenbusch was not the first time that King drew this type of connection. That had already taken root in college. But it was at that point in seminary that he began to have a theological framework for these types of ideas. His reading of Rauschenbusch would lead him to say things like this. Any religion which professes to be concerned about the souls of men and is not concerned about the social and economic conditions that scar the soul is a spiritually moribund religion only waiting for the day to be buried. That's a pretty strong language, right? 3 years later, King would enroll in a PhD program at Boston University School of Theology. As King finished up his PhD, he would then accept the position as pastor of Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery, Alabama. So in terms of King's early adult formation, we see him grow up in the Black Baptist Church, begin to recognize the relationship between the Black church and social justice in a Baptist college, and later a Baptist seminary, and then ultimately return to the Black Baptist Church as a pastor. This formation would later lead King to say these words in a 1965 interview. I am many things to many people, but in the quiet recesses of my heart, I am fundamentally a clergyman, a Baptist preacher. This is my being and my heritage, for I am also the son of a Baptist preacher, the grandson of a Baptist preacher, and the great-grandson of a Baptist preacher. For King, this link to the Black church will begin as a familial connection and blossom into a personal commitment to living out this tradition within the context of the civil rights movement. Ironically, King did not initially plan to be a civil rights hero. He'd wake up one day and say, you know what, that's what I want to be. Didn't do that. But key events would shape him into the figure that we remember today. One of the most pivotal moments in King's ministerial formation occurred a month after the beginning of the Montgomery bus boycott. He had become discouraged by the opposition they were encountering, and he would later pen these words. I was ready to give up. With my cup of coffee sitting untouched before me, I tried to think of a way to move out of the picture without appearing a coward. In the state of exhaustion, when my courage had all but gone, I decided to take my problem to God. With my head in my hands, I bowed over the kitchen table and prayed aloud. The words I spoke to God that midnight are still vivid in my memory. I am here taking a stand for what I believe is right, but now I am afraid. The people are looking to me for leadership, and if I stand before them without strength and courage, they too will falter. I am at the end of my powers. I have nothing left. I've come to the point where I can't face it alone. At that moment, I experienced the presence of the divine as I had never experienced God before. It seemed as though I could hear the quiet assurance of an inner voice saying, stand up for justice, stand up for truth, and God will be at your side forever. Almost at once, my fears began to go. My uncertainty disappeared. I was ready to face anything. 3 days later, his house would be bombed, but his family would escape. And King responded by saying, I accepted the word of the bombing clearly. My religious experience a few nights before had given me the strength to face it. I might need those. This part is like an extra, like, lip. One second.
My class period is not complete until I drop things and spill things and
knock things over. It's not good. So it's at this point, actually, that Cain got rid of his gun, right? It's at this point, and I think the rest is history. So now that we've covered a bit of historical ground, I'd like to spend some time outlining King's contributions to the civil rights movement, especially as a pastor and theologian. But first, I actually want to hear from you. From what you know about King, I'm curious if you feel like his life and his work resemble pastors with whom you are familiar. Do you feel like King kind of similar to pastors you may have encountered or seen or experienced? Or do you feel like he's unique? And why? What do you think? We live in the world of televangelism, so we've all probably seen a pastor or a preacher. But some of us may have actually been in a church, so I'm curious. Yeah?
I guess this kind of goes to what you were saying about the context in which he was living versus the context in which we live. Mm-hmm. But he was definitely more involved, at least, like, I mean, I didn't live when he was around, but it seems like he was more involved in the community and, like, broader activism outside of just, like, preaching within his own church. And pastors that I've seen or, like, church sources I've gone to, they kind of just more stay confined to their church and, like, the people that attend their church services rather than ministering to the broader community.
Okay. So maybe one kind of point of dissimilarity is saying some contemporary pastors who are not quite as engaged or active outside of their church, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, go for it.
The organization you brought up in your first lecture, Abundant Life, I feel like pastors who are affiliated with that organization are more community organizers. Mm-hmm. And I also think, like, Robert Cunningham specifically is really engaged with the community and makes an effort to get to know his, like, surrounding neighbors. And,
It's great. Great example. Any other examples?
I guess you know how widely the MAGA Christian movement is invoking King to justify their new way of engaging the political order.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's what's a little scary, right? It's like, on one level, there's a question of, to what degree does King actually resemble or reflect things we see in our current culture in terms of pastoral practice? But that's separate from the question of what are the similarities people perceive that actually aren't similarities, right? Which is a whole thing, right? But I do think, you know, in our context, there are some pastors who are trying to kind of situate themselves within this tradition, right? This tradition of Christian social engagement. And at the same time, there are pastors who run from that for different reasons. Another kind of, I think, point of, I feel like dissonance in terms of what I've seen in churches is King had a concern not just for his church being involved in the community, but he had a concern for churches beyond his church and even people groups beyond America, right? And so he had such an expansive imagination around what it means to promote and participate within the kingdom of God, or what he might, you know, use language of love and community, obviously, which I feel like, you know, I grew up Baptist, and Baptists have a what's called more of an autonomous polity. And so a lot of times Baptist churches can operate in silos, especially if they're not affiliated with a broader convention. And so that's the way I grew up, right? You know, we're kind of like in our own lane, doing our own thing. And that is like the exact opposite of the way that King approached ministry. So much of how he thought about ministry and just engaging and making the world a better place was inclusive and expansive. And so we'll come back to this theme of like how King might relate to or even speak to our current context later on. But yeah, go for it.
I was going to say, one thing I've noticed being in college versus like the church that I go to at home, which is a much like older, kind of more like suburban congregation, is that the college ministries that I've attended and been involved in have a much more community focused outlook and like are much more involved in engaging the community and doing service projects and like reaching out to more members. So that was something I thought was really interesting, this idea of like when it's being led by more of the youth, it has more of that like outward facing approach versus, I'm from Tallahassee, Florida, and I go to a, like an Anglican church in Tallahassee, so it's a very different vibe,
yeah.
But it's much more like inward focused versus what like the college ministries are doing.
Why do you think that difference exists? Like what do you think leads college ministries to operate differently?
I think there's a lot of factors. I think there's a big push, especially right now, to pull in maybe like college-age students who aren't involved in religion, aren't involved in Christianity, and provide a very inclusive environment that feels more welcoming for them to get involved in. And so there's a large focus on curiosity and this idea of being non-judgmental to people who don't really know as much about what's going on within the church, and that makes it much easier, I think, to do outreach work in like the college setting. And you get to access more of like an academic side and allow people to approach it from not just a faith-based point of view, but also just like this is something that I want to learn more about in like an academic context.
Fascinating. There's a so there's a sociologist, well, the brother of someone who we talk about today, but a guy named H. Richard Niebuhr, who wrote a book called The Social Sources of Denominationalism. And one of the things he talks about in that book is he talks about this, what he calls kind of the church-sect continuum. And so the idea is that you can have a group of people who are like, you know, passionate about ministry or passionate about, you know, starting something new and fresh in their community. And over time, they usually accumulate resources, they get bigger, they have more structures. And what could happen is they move from being kind of more missional in their focus to be more focused on self-preservation, because now you have a machine to maintain. And so I think about that with this kind of church ministry versus campus ministry distinction, because in campus ministry, you have new people every year, right? Like you kind of have to start afresh in some ways every year. You kind of have to reimagine, okay, who are we for this context in this moment? Whereas church institutions oftentimes become more ossified. And so I wonder, like, because I feel like I've seen that trend in a lot of churches where self-preservation becomes what we put 90% of our resources, whether that's maintaining the building or keeping our staff or whatever, in terms of, instead of saying, oh, where do we need to invest, right? Where can we send people to do outreach and that type of thing? And so I think what's interesting with King, though, is that, you know, he's able to pastor church and all these things, and their church is participating in the civil rights movement, who are effectively doing ministry in their own context. But in some ways, self-preservation looks differently, because now, because of racism, that actually is a threat to your preservation, but actually pulls you outside of your church in some ways. Whereas now in our context, a lot of times, not that oppression doesn't still exist, it does, but now I think self-preservation looks like maintaining your structures, because we don't actually feel the same type of threat. And so, anyway, so we'll come back to some of these themes, but it's interesting to see the ways that, yeah, our current context compares to the way that ministry operated within his context. Any other comments on this before we keep rolling? Okay, cool. So let's take a look at some of the key features of King's preaching and his speaking. I want to begin with King's understanding of the beloved community. And we'll stay on this for a while. But King likely took this phrase from 19th century thinker Josiah Royce. But whereas Royce used it within the context of idealist philosophy, in King's hands, this phrase took on this new concrete meaning. King would use this phrase to capture what was at stake in the civil rights struggle. After the Montgomery bus boycott, King said these words. It is true that as we struggle for freedom in America, we will have to boycott at times. But we remember that as we boycott, that boycott is not an end within itself. The end is reconciliation. The end is redemption. The end is the creation of the beloved community. It is this type of spirit and this type of love that can transform opposers into friends. It is this love which will bring about miracles in the hearts of men. This notion of beloved community will become a recurring theme in King's speeches and writings. And I'm curious, from what you've heard or read, whether it be in this class or outside of this class, what ideas does this phrase, beloved community, elicit for you? What do you think he means by this phrase? What comes to mind?
Just like the community of saints, there's no borders, there's no lines, there's no segregation.
Okay. Yeah, so something about the inclusivity of the phrase, right? Any other things? Yeah.
I feel like the word beloved implies that it's like what divinity would prefer or would like ordain for an earthly community. Like, just the choice of the word beloved is very, like, latent with biblical connotation.
Yeah. And there's, like, so there's a relational component there, too, though, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anything else? So what I'm going to talk about is a few aspects of this phrase. This is not an exhaustive list because there's a lot even within these two words. The first thing I want to say is that for King, the beloved community involved peace. Peace, in his view, had to go beyond mere tolerance or existence. Instead, peace was about justice and making things right in the world. Peace was about all people having equal access and opportunity in American society. This goes back to the inclusiveness that I don't remember your name, but the guy up front mentioned. So peace is really important. And just as importantly, love. Love is super important. Love provides the motive for pursuing justice, and it is the fuel that sustains these efforts. And he would often talk about agape love, right? And so I won't go into all the details, but like in the Greek, agape has to do with a certain kind of unconditional love, right? You have eros, which is more of a romantic type of love. You have philios or philia, which is more of like, you know, sibling type love. But agape love is what he has in mind here. And this emphasis on love was a clear indication of King's Christian heritage, as Jesus' teachings on the love of neighbor and even the love of enemy shaped King's social praxis. Now, the primary strategy for pursuing the beloved community was nonviolent direct action. Nonviolent direct action. King's concern for nonviolence was shaped by the practices of Mahatma Gandhi in India, and his conviction that nonviolent direct action could coerce others into compliance was influenced by theologian and ethicist Ronald Niebuhr.
We've read.
Fantastic. At one point, King would even say, "We've come to see that we've got to use tools of coercion. Not only is this thing a process of education, but it is a process of legislation." In other words, nonviolent direct action could foster concrete social change. Now, I don't know about you, but when I first started learning about these aspects of King's thought and the things that he did, one question would always come to my mind. What was it that made King so compelling? What made him so convincing? It's one thing to have good ideas, but a lot of people have good ideas. How do you go from having good ideas to launching a world-changing movement? I have some thoughts on this, but first let me stop and ask you, from your perspective and what you've learned so far, what do you think are some of the reasons why King was so compelling of a figure? What made him stand out? Yeah. Okay, nice, yeah. So he has a certain type of, eloquence, even like gravitas, stage presence, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe shaped by his own black church formation. Yeah.
I think his ability for his words to impact people beyond it, like, just anyone who listens to him is like, yeah,
mm-hmm.
I understand.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be religious context.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. Yeah, that's so interesting, right? Like, he's a super well-read, you know, PhD-holding guy who's somehow able to really connect with people at the grassroots level, right? And to be accessible in that way. And to speak and preach in a way that's accessible. Other things? Yeah.
I mean, I think it's memorable because it's almost against the grain of, like, you think about civil rights and human rights revolts or issues over time, and normally that has always been associated with violence.
Mm.
And so going against the grain of what is quote-unquote normal for enacting change that nonviolence would speak to people in a different way.
That's good. Yeah, so there's something unique about him kind of going against the grain in his approach, right? Any others? Okay, now I could not do a lecture on MLK and us not hear MLK. So I've got to play a little bit. It's probably about a 2-minute clip, and I want us to reflect on this. And what I want you to think about is, you know, as you hear his words, this is from his mountaintop sermon towards the end of his life. What kind of structure stands out to you about the way that he preached and what made him a blind devil figure? All right, let's see if this works.
America, is be true to what you're saying on paper. If I lived in China or even Russia or any totalitarian country, maybe I could understand some of these illegal injunctions. Maybe I could understand the denial of certain basic First Amendment privileges because they haven't committed themselves to that over there. But somewhere I read of the freedom of assembly. Somewhere I read of the freedom of speech. Somewhere I read of the freedom of press. Somewhere I read that the greatness of America is the right to protest far right. And so just as I say we aren't going to let any dogs or water hoses turn us around, we aren't going to let any injunction turn us around. What will happen now? We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you. But I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. My eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
All right. All right. What do you notice from that? You think about this question of like what made him such a compelling figure. What stood out to you from that clip? Who'd seen him before? Oh man, okay, so fresh for many years. Great. Yeah.
Say confidence.
Just confidence?
He's like full belief in what he's saying. Like there's no hesitation.
Mm-hmm. That's good, yeah.
I also feel like there's like a level of, I'm thinking about like when he rewrites St. Paul's letter too, is like a love of creativity and like how he's like using his biblical allusions to like write the black people into these biblical allusions and like how powerful that like they've been written out of the white Southern church for so long, that's changing.
Yeah, we're going to return to that theme. One phrase for it is called narrative identification. All right, we're going to come back to that theme. That's a really good point. Yeah.
I would say he definitely fed on the audiences of like their energy. Because there was a lot of like calm and response with the audience. So like at certain times he got loud and the audience also got loud.
So there's an aspect of this that is actually dialogical, right? It's actually not just him preaching, it's him participating in a communal act with the congregation. So there's a calm and response back and forth. Yes.
Going off of that, I can see also able to express the emotions of autism in a way that they might not be able to. Like he's able to share the anger and frustration at the system, but in a more eloquent way and a more leader influenced position. But like everything he's expressing is nothing new to the
Really good. I think there's something about the authenticity that comes through because people know his life. They know he's actually in the struggle with them, and that's helping to enhance how compelling this is because they know, like, oh, he's speaking of what he's experienced. Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like with that, as he's leading, he's not self-righteous, you know? Like, he's not any better than any of them. He's, like, relating to all of them. And I think the humility with that, definitely, it, like, speaks very well.
Yeah, that's good. Humility and the relatability. Really important. Anything else? I mean, there are all these other, like, mechanical things happening, right? With this cadence, with this intonation, right? Mm-hmm. With even thinking about the repetition. Bill Turner, who's a professor at Duke, he would talk about the musicality of black preaching. Mm-hmm. And so you can see kind of how that, he's not just reading a speech, right? He is actually engaging in this, in some ways, this, how this is a musical and the sonic quality to how he's doing this, right? Anything else? I mean, the other point,
you mentioned the gravitas. Mm-hmm. I hadn't seen that clip in a while, and I was just struck by the kind of weight and heaviness and the mournfulness of this tone.
Yeah. That is so interesting, right? Because it's like, in some ways, a very high energy moment, but also a very somber moment at the same time. He's able to embody both of those things.
Right.
I
thought it was very interesting his reference to the mountaintop, like kind of reminded Mount Sinai in the Old Testament, and then how Moses doesn't see the promised land, and then kind of similar to like Martin Luther King Jr. with like how he's like ended.
Yes.
Yeah. Not actually completely seeing his dream and what he imagined America's future to be, but it obviously came to fruition. He didn't get to observe that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's like, in some ways, kind of a dual echo, right? There's the echo of, you know, Moses being on Mount Sinai, but also an echo of Moses on Mount Nebo. So right at the end of Moses' life, he's on Mount Nebo, where he's not allowed to go into the promised land. Mm-hmm. And so he's kind of positioning himself as that figure. And even with him saying things like, you know, I just want to do God's will, it makes me think about, I don't know if he's trying to do this, but it's also an echo of Gethsemane, right? So before Jesus dies, he's in the Garden of Gethsemane, and what he says is, you know, not my will, but my Father's will be done. Right, because he's on the path to death, but he's saying, I'm going to submit completely to what God wants. And so there's this idea of narrative identification. Right? He's positioning himself as these specific archetypes, and we'll come back to that in a moment. But also, he's drawing the rest of the crowd into that story as well, because he's positioning them as Israel, as the people of God, getting ready to experience the promised land. Any other comments on that? Okay. So King's approach to ministry was greatly shaped by how he read and interpreted the Bible. And you see some of that in that clip. He often employed what's called a figural hermeneutic, a way of interpreting the Bible that was common within black churches, and a way of interpreting it that dates back to the antebellum or pre-Civil War era. This approach affirmed continuity between biblical figures or tropes and contemporary people. Typology was the most significant type of figural interpretation for African-American hermeneutics, or the way they would read scripture. And King's understanding of the Exodus was one key way that he would employ this. And so typology affirms continuity between figures and events as they are repeated in the Bible, and as similar figures and events occur in subsequent history. And so in the hands of King, the Exodus becomes not just an historical account of Israel's deliverance, but an archetype, a story of liberation that is echoed in subsequent liberative moments throughout history. And that could be the black struggle in America, but also other struggles for justice and liberation throughout the world. And so I want to walk through, kind of unpack a bit of what this is. So some examples you would see of how those in black communities would do this, from slavery to today in some ways, are connected between slavery in Egypt, slaves in Israel, emancipation in the Exodus, and, you know, especially during the antebellum South, connecting specific liberative figures with people like Moses. And so, to give you kind of an example of how this will show up even in, I'll see you right now, won't go to the next slide yet. But let me just say this, this shows up not only like the rhetoric of preaching, right? You see this with MLK, this also happens throughout Black Christian music. And so if we take as an example, go down Moses. Oh, the Lord said, go down Moses, way down in Egypt's land, tell old Pharaoh, let my people go. And you can see how this gets appropriated. Oh, Father Abraham, Lincoln, go down into Dixie's land in the south, tell Jefferson Davis to lead the Confederacy or Federal Army, to let my people go down in the house of bondage. So you can see the way that this, what we would call like a typological way of reading scripture, can manifest even in song to help people to situate themselves within this story of liberation and within the story of what God is doing in the world. And so within African American hermeneutics or biblical interpretation, the category of typology cannot be equated or reduced to just being mere symbols or analogies. And there's two reasons why this is, and I'm drawing from a guy named Keith Miller and also Rick Lisher, who are both scholars of King. First, recurring types are understood more literally than analogies. What I mean by this is that Black Christians suffering under slavery or Jim Crow did not just assume that they were similar to biblical Israel, they saw themselves as actually being God's people. It's a bit stronger of a statement. And I should also say that this isn't some form of replacement theology. They don't replace Israel. It's just identification with the community of Israel. The second important thing to note is that these types are broader than just mere symbols because they connote a worldview beyond the isolated, repeated figure or event. In other words, it isn't just about drawing this simple one-to-one correlation between oppressed Blacks in Israel or America and Egypt. Black Christians instead saw themselves as inhabiting the broader religious worldview associated with the Exodus narrative. Typology is about identification with a community, but also the inhabitation of that community's world. So on the one hand, the expansiveness of Exodus typology is clear from how multiple aspects of the narrative of the story are given contemporary appropriations, including Egypt, Pharaoh, and Moses. Yet beyond the particularities of figures such as Moses or Pharaoh, the Exodus narrative painted a bigger picture of how God interacts with humanity and shaped how slaves understood their own journeys and how Blacks post-slavery would understand their own journeys. Much of the effectiveness of the Exodus as a communal theme has been due to its interpretive capacity and its expansiveness. It provides a lens that is nuanced enough to accommodate a wide variety of corporate experiences. As Gary Selby, a King scholar, would note, he said the Exodus explained the successes they experienced, the problems they faced, and the disappointments that they suffered. In preaching, and especially in the singing of spirituals, Black slaves were drawn to the Exodus for these reasons. And as Union Army chaplain, you know, a long time ago, W.G. Kiffant reflected, he said that there's no part of the Bible with which the slaves are so familiar as the story of the deliverance of the children of Israel. So the conviction that the Exodus was a communal archetype and interpretive framework will resound throughout African-American Christian history in general and resonate with King in particular. This conviction led King not only to identify the story of Israel with the story of Black Americans, but with the stories of all contemporary movements worldwide that sought liberation of oppressed groups. King's hermeneutical and homiletical sensibilities, i.e. his reading of scripture and his preaching, were incubated in the church, but also influenced by his theological training. In addition to his familiarity with ways of engaging scripture within the Black church, or the Baptist church, Crozier Seminary further exposed King to higher biblical criticism while he was a student. Studying under figures such as George Washington Davis informed how King negotiated his commitments to evangelical faith alongside theologically liberal perspectives. Theological liberalism informed King's concern for the universal truths of the Bible, whereas evangelicalism, within the context of Jim Crow, not the current political evangelicalism, made connecting these truths with practical realities indispensable. As King scholar Rick Lisher says, between the pre-critical tradition of the Black church and the higher criticism have a liberal tradition of the exegetes. The theologian Davis mediated to King a progressive method of interpretation that moved from the particular to the universal and the corporate to the personal. Put more simply, King was often asking the big picture question. What do the specific claims and events of the Bible mean to the world and for us? King's formative experiences in the South and later in seminary would shape how he read the Bible in the pew as well as the pulpit. And in the hands of King, the Exodus would become a primary tool for illuminating the universal truth of God's liberative work, as well as empowering people to engage that work practically. King was influenced by both liberalism, or theological liberalism, which you probably touched on a bit with Rauschenbusch, and also neo-orthodoxy. Liberalism in many ways involved this tendency to understand God on the basis of universal human experience. So you have people like Schleiermacher, who you probably haven't read, but I'll just mention him, who would define religion as being about this internal feeling of absolute dependence on God. Or we'd have people like biblical scholars like Albert Schweitzer, who view the veracity of biblical claims through the lens of modern assumptions. Experience became the lens and in some ways the litmus for religious experience and expression. Another kind of aspect of theological liberalism during this time, especially in the early 20th century, was that it became susceptible to identifying Christianity with expressions of state or culture. Something else to keep in mind. We see that more in Germany, but that's a whole other conversation with Nazis. But another kind of feature of theological liberalism was human optimism and agency. And so you saw this, I'm sure, with Rauschenbusch. But it also impacted King, at least in his early life. And he would say things like, man is neither good nor bad by nature, but has potentialities for either. Or he would say, our Christian religion says something says somehow that a prejudiced mind can be changed. Right? He had this optimistic outlook. But he's also influenced by some of kind of the more neo orthodox trends that kind of felt like liberalism had over-accommodated to the modern world, kind of making human experience the center of religious discourse. And so instead, kind of the more neo-orthodox vein is to say, no, like, God is transcendent, right? This isn't just about human experience and understanding everything through that, but it's about recognizing that God is beyond that. And so in light of this, you know, even prior to this class, you've been exposed to MLK in some form or fashion, I'm sure. And one of the things I talked about in my first lecture here was this idea of what it means to theologically engage or theologically read things, right? To come in contact with a text or even a sermon or some type of raw data to engage and to say, oh, what's the theology underneath this? What are some of the core assumptions? What are the guiding values? So I want us to do a little bit of that. As you think about what you know about King, what do you think are some of the core theological assumptions that guided or informed his work and his witness? What do you think are some of his core assumptions theologically? Or philosophically, yeah.
I just have a question, but I think it's related.
Okay.
I was wondering if you could give a little context of like liberation theology and how it came to this. And like, because that came out of the Latin American church, right?
Yes.
And then like, how that fits in with like the Black church and where he is in this whole larger storyline.
Yeah. Yeah, so two kind of key figures at the inception of kind of liberation theology are usually Gustavo Gutierrez, who passed within the last, what, year?
Mm-hmm.
Wrote a book called Theology of Liberation, Latin scholar out of Peru. The year that was published, 1960 or 70. Mm-hmm. But you also have folks like James Cone,
right.
Who releases Black Power and Black Theology, Black Power and Black... Gosh, I'm going to tell you. Black Theology and Black Power, then Theology of Liberation, and then God of the Oppressed. So you have these two figures, and other figures as well. They're kind of coming, in some ways, King passed in 1968, right? And so it wasn't necessarily that they informed King, but they're kind of coming on the heels of the work of King and others. There's a lot to say about liberation theology. But I think one thing that it kind of reminds us of, that broader conversation, is that this is a conversation beyond even the states. And King was able to see that, right? He's able to see, oh, there are these movements for liberation beyond the states. So what does it mean for us to understand our role within the story of God, but also our role within the story of liberative movements happening everywhere. And this is actually a global phenomenon. And it's actually in thinking about that, and thinking about justice that way, that helps inform his work, right? Like, there's a reason why he's learning from folks like Mahatma Gandhi, right? He has a sensibility that is actually global, but then becomes hyper-local in his own context. And you see that kind of picked up in some ways with liberation theology, because folks, thinkers within that tradition are in conversation beyond the American context, but they're all saying, okay, so in my own neck of the woods, what does this look like, and how do I push for justice? But great, great question. There's a lot more to say about that. yeah, and the other things that you think about kind of King's work, King's writings, what are maybe some of the theological assumptions or core convictions that guide that? Yeah. Right, so in theology we call this the Imago Dei, right, the image of God. So there is this assumption that King has that we're all actually made in the image of God, meaning we all have inherent dignity that's given by God. And I think the other thing about that for King is that it's not just that we're all made in the image of God, but we're all also connected with one another in a certain type of way.
Yeah, it makes me want to plug a book.
Go for it.
Did you ever cross paths with Richard Wills in graduate school here?
That name sounds really familiar.
He was one of my first doctoral students. And
oh, wow.
He
okay.
had been the pastor at Dexter Avenue for 11 years before he returned to graduate studies. And then when he finished here, he went to Friendship Baptist in Atlanta, and he had a gig at Morehouse College. But his dissertation was on the idea of the image of God, and it was published eventually as a book called Martin Luther King Jr. and the Idea of the Image of God, and it just sort of traces that through his thinking and the antecedents of his thought.
Excellent.
I thought you were, I guess you came in after Richard was gone.
I think so. But the name does sound familiar.
He was pastor in had a pastor in Richmond. I'll have to figure out a way to connect the two.
It is a small world.
Yeah, this small.
But yeah, the image of God, like that is a core theological conviction. Are there any other values that you see informing his writings? Yeah. So there's something very, Christocentric, right, about how he's engaging his work. It's steeping it within how he understands who Jesus was in the world. And it's not even just that, he believes that Jesus came to save the world, so he wants to follow that. It's that, no, there's a particular way that Jesus engages in that work, which has a certain type of attentiveness and sensitivity to those who are on the margins. And he would see that as also connected to the Old Testament, right, or the Hebrew Bible. And kind of like there being this kind of grand story of how God is seeking to bring the oppressed into freedom. Mm-hmm. Any other assumptions? Yeah.
I don't know if you mentioned this, but kind of this idea of like mutuality and interconnectedness. And like, I'm trying to remember his phrasing of like.
Mutual garment of destiny?
Maybe. Oh. Yeah. The like elaborate interweavingness.
Yeah. It's a powerful aspect of his thinking, right? And I think part of why that is so important is he's seeing that is a deficiency in like modern sensibilities, right? Especially in a very individualistic Western world, we often do not act as if we're very connected to other people, and especially people who don't look like us, right? So it's kind of pushing us in a different way.
It's that line from page 3 of my letter from Williams in jail. We are caught. This is the phrase you just used. We're caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly, and it's beautiful. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's great. Any other things? I think one. Well, I have a few things in mind, but I think that for King, he has specific what we call ecclesiology, a specific conception of the church. And that conception of the church involved the church being active in the world, being an active agent, and in some ways a conduit of divine liberation for oppressed peoples. So that's, I think, it's really, really important. Another core assumption that guided his work is just the role of scripture, right? Like, it's, in theory, he could have a bunch of speeches and talk about, hey, we should like help other people and help them be free because it's a good thing, or because it promotes the common good or whatever. And he does do that. but he's also grounding it within the specific interpretive tradition of this specific text. Mm. And I think it's really important to note. Another kind of theological phrase that people use is divine immanence, which has to do with God's presence in the world. And so, you know, there's a very old tradition in our country, especially with the founding fathers, of people being like what we call deists. So kind of this idea of like God exists, God created the world, but God is not actively involved in, you know, the everyday activities of the world. That's not King, right? King believes that God is not only present, but active, working through the church and working through others to bring about liberation. And so it makes kind of the push for liberation not just about social justice, but about a theological vision that's informing that. Any other things come to mind for you in terms of maybe some core theological assumptions or convictions that you kind of see in some of his writings or his work? Okay. Cool. I should also mention, King has an interesting understanding of Jesus, right? And I remember back when I was a student, there's a lot of conversation about, like, how does he understand who Jesus is? Like, is Jesus divine? Is he not divine? Is something in the middle? And I won't get into all the minutiae of philosophical theology around this. But for King, King does place an emphasis on Christ's humanity, right? That Christ was human. At one point he says, Jesus overcame his temptations not by reliance on some inherent divine dimension, but by the constancy of his will. So we are moved to the conclusion on the basis of preemptory evidence that Jesus shared fully in human life. So the way that King would often talk about it is he would not talk about divinity as this inherent, substantial, or metaphysical unity with God, but more as a relational unity that manifests as obedience and submission to God. And so, in some ways, what Christ does as a result of that is he gives us an example of what that can look like, even though Christ's identity is beyond just being an example. And so, I want to mention that. But the other thing is just, you know, the theological term for this is eschatology, which is the idea of like the end times or the last things, or like how things kind of wrap up, or the, you know, ultimate future of the world. And, you know, King has some shifts with this over his life. I mentioned earlier kind of the influence of theological liberalism and the optimism that comes with that. You know, think about Rauschenbusch and others in that vein. But as King got older, I feel like people go through this trend a lot in our culture where, you know, you're really optimistic about the world, and then the world kind of slaps you, and then you realize, oh, this is not quite what I expected. And so we see that in some of his writings and in his speeches, where like the optimism is not quite the same. And I didn't realize this till Dr. Marsh's lecture, probably now 15 years ago, about this. But you know, at the same time, he still clung to this vision of the beloved community, and. You know, for him, the beloved community is the realization of divine love lived in social relation, as Marsh put it, Dr. Marsh put it years ago. And so, one thing that I love about what King does, particularly as we think about his reading of Scripture, is that he's looking at, you know, what is said in Scripture, or looking at, you know, the biblical witness or the Christian tradition or whatever, and then he's bringing it into the present moment. He's saying, okay, this is what God did with Israel. What does that mean for us today? And so actually what I want us to do is I want us to perform a bit of what King does. And what I mean by that is I want us to ask the question, what can today's movements toward liberation or whatever, what can we learn today from King? And what ways might his example inform our current reality? Because I don't know if you noticed, there are a lot of things happening in the world. Oppression still exists in a more forms than I can name. And even when oppression is not extreme, the idea of, like, there's a big space between oppression on the one hand and like human flourishing on the other hand. And so there's a lot of opportunity for us to continue to move as a country and as a world towards actual human flourishing. And so I'm curious for you, like, when you think about King's witness, what do you think that it can say to our current moment? And what ways can his words, his witness, his writings, his work inform justice today? Is it a relic of the past, or is it relevant today? And how? sat there and then go there. And it's especially important given how polarized our world is, right? And also how violent our world is, right? So this idea of nonviolence is super, super helpful and important. Yeah.
This is a really specific example, but nonprofit I work for does peacemaking work in Israel, Palestine, and they recently brought Palestinian activists to like go through like kind of a civil rights pilgrimage and like tour of the U.S. South and like meet with people and see sites and everything. And so that was like very tangible. Like, let's look at the work of MLK, but lots of others, and see like how that can inform this like liberation and like nonviolence movement in Palestine. So that was like really cool.
That's great. And I mean the sad thing is, all the things about King Rose, the sad thing is that they're so relevant because our world actually isn't that different, even though it's very different, right? But it creates the opportunity for saying, oh, this is something we can transpose into the present.
And there's like that imagination that we were talking about earlier, and like hope that like in the anger and realness of the moment, there's like hope
Yeah, that's great.
I think that something he emphasized was this idea of time not being something that's going to fix everything. Like, it's not like as we go through time, things are going to get better, or like these issues are going to be solved. And there's a lot of talk like surrounding the election. I feel like there's a lot of people saying, oh, like, I can't believe this is happening in 2025. Like, this is not who we are. This is not who America is. And this idea that, like, because we've gotten to this point in contemporary thought and, like, we've reached this, like, numerical number, oh, it's 2025, these things shouldn't be happening anymore, is kind of a detrimental thing that King would have disagreed with and said, like, no, thinking about the year as, like, a reason for things to not be happening kind of gets you stuck in this, like, hopeless mindset when we need to be focused on, like, making the changes now. So I think that would be interesting.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it raises a lot of interesting questions about how we think about the inevitability of progress and where that inevitability is located or housed, mm-hmm. right? To what extent is that a divine truth that, oh, like, God will make sure that everything works on the end? And to what degree is that actually a question of human agency? And to what degree are those things not mutually exclusive questions, right? And so I think that's, yeah, there's a lot to unpack there, but I feel like that's one kind of dynamic at play of, like, how do we, like, yeah, what does it mean to have the level of urgency that affirms that humans do have agency? But also, what does it mean to also not always think it's just up to us and our own human power, within a Christian framework at least, right? It's interesting. Other thoughts on this? Yeah.
Well, I don't know what Dr. Marsh was referencing with MAGA Christians, like, twisting King's words. I know that both sides have been doing that with Bonhoeffer, but I hear a lot of the same language between, like, the social gospel movement, like King, and but then also Christian nationalists. And so I can see how they would take those words and twist them and use them for, like, Rauschenbusch, one of the readings says, like, we need to Christianize all nations. And, like, they could totally take that and twist those words and bring that into politics and try to Christianize America and through all the churches and stuff.
Well, I mean, that's an important point that, like, as we're thinking about how someone's work and words can be transposed in the present, it can be used in a lot of different ways, right? Which raises a lot of questions about, like, how do you know, you know, what are kind of the guideposts for faithful interpretations and faithful applications of someone's core convictions and claims? Other thoughts on this?
Kind of along the same lines as what Marshall was saying, like the belief that King and Niebuhr and Rauschenbusch had about personal salvation necessitating social action, and like the, I think one thing we talked about was like the selfishness almost of individual piety if it doesn't like affect anything else about the world around you. And I feel like that kind of goes into what Marshall was saying about the like Christian nationalist movement and like an us versus them mentality of like protecting an in-group without having an emphasis on social change for the greater good.
Good point. Anything else? I will say for me, I think that one thing that I take away from King is I think it's a reminder of the power of storytelling for movements and for social change. Like, if I'll speak for myself, I think about our world or our country and the different things that are gaining steam, whether it be MAGA movement or whether it be other movements, so much of it is actually about storytelling. So much of it is about inviting people into a way of seeing the world and a way of understanding kind of their positions within the trajectory of the world. And obviously this can be used for great ways or nefarious, you know, ways, but I think there is an opportunity for those who are, you know, invested in the work of justice in the world to say, what does it mean to tell a story that is true and a story that will help people to be able to see themselves in it and a story that will help them to be convicted enough and to have the level of urgency necessary to put in the work to pursue and promote justice in the world. Another thing that I think that we can take with King is just the power of coalition building, that he's not just working in the silo with one type of person, but he's actually inviting all people to see themselves connected and to all be engaged in a collective effort to pursue and promote justice in the world. And so I think a lot of the most powerful movements in the world are those that actually cross different boundaries and borders. To kind of invite more people into the promotion of that particular dream or vision. Any other things you feel like we can learn from King?
Yeah, you know, just the idea of love of country and patriotism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, King does differentiate himself from a lot of the discourse of the new or cultural left in his fidelity to the idea of America. And the essence of America an appeal that the civil rights movement from 1955 to 1964 made in, you know, sincerity and forthrightness. Donald Shriver wrote this wonderful book called Honest Patriotism.
Hmm.
And so, you know, the idea of a critical or honest patriotism, a patriotism that affirms love of country, but is also willing and open to think critically about its history and its failures, but also cleaving to these ideals that has animated this extraordinary project, you know. And King, you know, intones, you know, the language of the Exodus, but also and the language of Gandhi and of the Sermon on the Mount, alongside the language of not American exceptionalism, but, you know, American idealism, without apology.
Yeah. You know, what you said, it reminds me of, like, I think another thing that will probably change our entire country. If we actually began to believe that we don't have to be afraid of our history, I think that would actually change a lot of things. Because probably what you named earlier and what you said was, like, the ways that we can have the idealism, but also be honest about all that our nation is fraught with. And that's actually an opportunity for us to progress, as opposed to it being something to you know, deny or pretend doesn't exist. And so, in our last couple minutes, what I want you to do is I want you to respond to this question with a Twitter or X-linked response, so roughly one sentence, 144 characters, but don't count the characters. And that question is, what would King say to us today as a country? Okay? Just take 2 minutes, you know, X-linked response, tweet. What would King say to us today? And that us can be our country, that us could be the church, that us could be all peoples. You can define the us. What would he say?
thanks for that question. That is such a fabulous, you know, segue into Beyond Vietnam.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Buckle up your seatbelts. So see a few pencils moving. 30-second move. Be interested in sharing. I saw all your hands moving, so I know we've got a lot of interest in there. Yeah.
I just thought the first thing I thought of was you foolish Galatians.
Oh.
You foolish Galatians. Just yeah. Like quit it.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot there.
Yeah, that's
good. Other ideas? Would he have something to say? Okay. I see some time. Yeah, is your hand up?
I don't know what he would say, but I think that he would probably focus on like the lack of love that there currently is in his country with how divisive, like every single conversation and like everything is so divisive. There's like no reach for love between any sort of disagreement, and that was such a focal point of all of his teachings. That there will never be peace, there will never be unity, there will never be any kind of equality without love, and we're kind of like totally void of love right now.
Yeah. I love that. I run with. Yeah, I love that, you know, for his in his work, he's so driven by the end goal, right? The beloved community, and that's kind of informing the whole path. When I was thinking about what to write, I was like, thinking about all these specific things, and I'm like, well, actually, at the end of the day, it is actually about love. Whatever it was, love is more powerful than hate, you know? So, any other things? Yeah. That's great. I do think, I mean, I love that because one thing he embodied alongside love is boldness, right? To be able to speak confidently in those regard spaces that got him killed, you know? It takes a certain type of person, so. Any other things? Anybody want the last excellent response before we close out?
I think he would have something to say about our consumerism and how that creates like the power dynamics in America and that separating us.
Consumerism.
It's very consumerism and capitalism. That's
necessary. Yeah. Consumerism. We're gonna have a lot of fun things to talk about with you know, the economics of this. All right. Well, we're out of time. But thank you for
thank you. That was just fantastic.
Thank you.
Welcome back anytime. How's Thursday?
Perfect. I think I'm going to do it Thursday. I'm doing something. I don't really know what, but this is fun. This sounds like being back in the day.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.